Love Osho podcast brings you the real stories of the people whose lives have been inspired and transformed by Osho. We explore why thousands of people are falling in love with Osho and where to find them. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Love Osho podcast. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Max Brecker. Max is a former New York political journalist and author of 5 books, including A Passage to America, an investigative journalistic account of the events around Rajneeshpuram. A Passage to America systematically explores the complex sequence of events that led to Osho's deportation and the collapse of 150 million commune city in the Oregon Desert. Based entirely on historical records and more than 100 interviews conducted in the United States, Europe, and India, the book re-examines old misconceptions in the light of new evidence and proves beyond a doubt that there was a conspiracy against Osho and his message. Hello, Max, and welcome back to part 2 of this fascinating talk about some of the most controversial, confusing, and unknown facts around Rajneeshpuram and Osho's life in the USA. All of this, again, just to remind everyone, is part of your book, A Passage to America, a historical and evidence-based journalistic investigation into those events. In part 1, we discussed your motivation for writing the book. We went into some pretty detailed information about Osho's immigration status, the issue of land use, Osho's arrest and imprisonment, and many more things. Today, I'd like to pick up from where we left off and also talk a little bit about Osho and Sheila. The last part of Rajneeshpuram's story is, of course, Osho's trial and deportation. So let's talk about that. We established that there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Osho committed any crime. However, Osho was deported from the USA. And by reading your book, what I've learned is that Osho did not go through a full formal trial, but entered into a plea bargain, even though he was innocent. In fact, he wanted to fight in court, because obviously he was innocent, but his lawyers advised him to accept the deal for his own safety and to avoid further harassment. So can you please unpack this whole story and describe a bit more in detail what happened there?
Okay, well, that's a very good introduction. Thank you very much for that. The introduction, let's backtrack before we get to that. It wasn't a trial. It was just an appearance in court. So you can't, in any stretch of the imagination, call it a trial. The pressure on Rajneeshpuram had been very intense from the beginning. It kept on getting more and more intense. And most of that was coming from the side of outside forces, which were both governmental and, let's call it, private groups of people who just wanted to make a name for themselves by making a lot of noise. So it wasn't all just, you know, the government. It was also people in the area who are attacking them physically. There were actually people coming in there to try to blow things up. There was one guy, I think you remember that from the book, he was called in to blow things up at Rajneeshpuram, to actually assassinate Rajneesh. That guy's name was Don Stewart, and things like that. So it wasn't just the government. At the same time, I would like to say it wasn't everybody in the government was part of the conspiracy. There were lots of people in the government who were basically just doing their jobs, and they couldn't quite understand what all the noise was about. And I talked to those people as well. Okay, now you back up a little bit, and you see that the intense pressure on Rajneeshpuram, which then led Osho not to flee, but to fly. And that's the strange thing that they took advantage of. He flew. He didn't flee. And that was what they were really kind of depending on to make it look like, you know, he was escaping because he knew he was guilty and he had to, you know, get out of Dodge before sundown, that kind of story. Now, intense pressure, and then the intense pressure again in Charlotte, and then him being held incognito in Oklahoma and all that going on. There you have this, the buildup to the background for that. So that was a plea bargain. Now, the plea bargain, the issue from the plea bargain, the suggestion for the plea bargain didn't come from Rajneesh's lawyers. It came from the government because they basically, first of all, they wanted to get it over with as soon as possible. And they wanted to save face. And so it came from their side. And they knew that the pressure was intense on Rajneesh. And they knew that it was dangerous to have that hearing. So they took advantage of it. And Rajneesh's lawyers gave them, okay, they discussed it with him. And they said, okay, let's do it. And let's get it over with. Let's get the hell out of here. Because these guys are never going to give up. If they don't do this, they're going to do something else. And they just got to keep on going until something works. Okay, so that was the background for it. And one thing that most people who don't know much about American law don't understand is a concept known as prosecutorial misconduct, which means that the prosecution puts as much pressure on the defense to make them plea bargain so they don't have to argue cases. And a lot of those cases, in fact, quite a lot of those cases are dicey to non-existent. And therefore, they just put on the pressure and say, you know, you either sign on the bottom line or we're just going to, you know, nail your ass to the cross. So that's the way it works. Okay. And this is quite a known concept in the legal business that prosecutors misuse their power. And it's actually was bad then, but it's much, much worse now. Okay. So that's the background for the plea bargain. It's no big deal. It sounds like, whoa, okay, pleaded guilty. He wasn't guilty. And which then allowed the government to recoup a lot of the money that they had spent on the trial and then to come out and send waving papers and saying, okay, we won. And we told you all along these guys were bastards. And now this is the proof that they were. So that's the background for that story. Is that clear enough?
Yeah. Makes sense. But the headline is that there is a perception as if Osho responsible for some kind of fraud, even though obviously it wasn't the criminal activities committed by Sheila and her friends or gang, as it's called. But
wait a minute. Let me interrupt you there on that. About the immigration fraud, for example. First of all, that was basically, okay, I don't know. I imagine Sheila was doing that. I don't really know. I think there were a lot of people who just wanted to be at the ranch and they did their trips with or without anybody urging them to do it. So I actually don't know how much of that was just individuals doing that kind of sham marriages fraud. And there was quite a lot of that going on, obviously. How much of that was kind of people doing it, and how much of it was actually organized by some kind of central committee? I don't know about that. That's one thing. The other part of that is that if INS had accepted Rajneesh as Osho, as a spiritual leader, that meant this was a religious commune and they could have gotten a religious worker status. So basically, the motivation for the sham marriages was essentially forced on people who wanted to be there by the INS's stubborn and actually probably illegal refusal to recognize that this was a religious leader and these are religious workers. So therefore, that wouldn't have been necessary. Okay. So in terms of the immigration immigration stuff that was going on. I don't know who are going to say, but basically I placed the blame on that for on the INS itself. Okay.
Okay. So what you're saying is that the plea bargain concerned the immigration fraud. There's nothing to do
only with on that. Crimes. Only on that.
Even on the immigration fraud, essentially, there was, again, no evidence that Osho was responsible for this sham marriage, that it's down to the individual initiatives of the
Kenyans
to be in America. And unfortunately, they were not granted the visa because the INS took the stance that they wouldn't allow and grant visa to Sanyazins. So they had to find a way around that.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. That's the way it worked. Right. So it was the INS playing hardball, which forced them, you know, you build a mousetrap and then the mice get smarter. That's the way it works.
Okay. Well, that's now quite clear. Thanks for kind of unpacking that. Now let's move to something. It's quite critical. You know, it's a critical part of the whole puzzle.
Go for it.
The relationship between Osho and Sheela, or better to say, Osho's choice to appoint Sheela as the commander-in-chief of operations, if you like, with the results that we all know. So let's start from the beginning before going straight into the main thing. When did Sheela come into the picture? How did she manage to ascend to her role of leader and the spokesperson of Osho?
Okay, well, you're right about this being an extremely important and some would, especially for sannyasins, a central question is how did such a terrible person become in charge of the whole shebang and then allowed to do what she did, not only she, but her cohorts. Now, go back, Sheela, first, she came to Osho, I think in the early 70s with her American husband, who then later died. His name was Mark Silverman. And for some strange reason, she was always known as Sheela Silverman to the end of her days, or maybe even now. But she's been married twice since that time. One of them was to, his name was Jay. And another to another, a Swiss guy. By the way, she's in Switzerland under that last marriage. That's how she managed to stay in Switzerland. But according to me, that second marriage is not legal. So she was still married to Jay Schaefer or whatever his name was. Anyhow, so anyway, she came there in 1974, I think. And she was just one of the girls in the band, you know. And then she started to kind of basically work her way up. In other words, she was rather ambitious. But the one in charge in what they now call Pune One was Ma Lakshmi. You've never met her. I did an interview with her in 1989. Strangely enough, I did an interview with her in the ashram, or at least on one of the side tracks of the ashram, when she was technically not allowed in the ashram, which I only found out about, well, just recently. So Lakshmi was a strange bird. She talked in a very strange way. And she also, let's say, she wasn't as bad as Sheela in terms of misuse of power, but she was a little strange. So Osho had strange people in charge from the beginning because you're in a strange world and you can't have saints in charge. The world is not, you know, people who are saints who are not interested in politics. They're not going to kind of go up the ladder in an organization. A lot of them came there because they had done the political trip before and they weren't interested in doing it again. They had kind of seen how it was in that world and they were just fed up, sick of it. They didn't want to do it. That's why they went to Osho. They were fed up with the world as it was. So people hadn't been there, done that. They were the ones who, you know, they say shit rises to the top. And that's basically what happened there. Now, Sheela wasn't directly appointed. She was it was a sort of faux demur case. When Lakshmi was around looking for a place in India to move the new commune in the north of India and all that, Sheila basically started taking over and more. And then actually the American trip happened when the plan for the American trip happened when Lakshmi wasn't even in Pune. She was up north, so she hurried back and all that. So that was a kind of an infighting between Sheila and Lakshmi, and Sheila won. That's how it was. So whether she was actually appointed or anointed or whatever, she wound up in charge, and she kept her hands on the reins for as long as she could. Now, as I said in the last episode, as far as I can see in the beginning, she was very dynamic. That doesn't mean she wasn't a nasty bitch. She was, but you know, that happens in life. The people, you know, that's not criminal. Being a nasty bitch is not criminal offense. Otherwise, most of the women and men would be in jail. There'd be nobody outside. So anyhow, she was doing a great job and everything was going pretty smoothly. They were fighting the battles. They were winning a lot of them, losing some, but it was going all pretty well until I'd say the turning point for the whole show was 1984. And that was basically because they were thinking of taking over Wasco County, okay, with a share home program. When they had all these homeless people brought in at a cost, an incredible cost, an incredible disruption to the normal flow, and totally, it doesn't fit here. This kind of stuff doesn't go with what kind of this commune is. And that's when everything went haywire. In the book, I mentioned that that was sort of based on a kind of offhand joke by a political outside political advisor who I interviewed, by the way. And he said to me, well, as a joke, he said to them, well, the only way you can get through with it, all this, is to take over Wasco County. And he meant that as a joke. And they took it literally and seriously. And then when they had all those homeless people coming in, that's really when the whole story went off the rails. I mean, it was kind of wobbly for a long time, but I mean, that was the major point. Now, at that point, when there were already a lot of the homeless people at the ranch, OSHA started talking again for the first time since the end of Pune, publicly. In other words, Sheila no longer had the absolute control over what he said and who he talked to. Got it? This is 1984. He started talking again at the end of October, 1984, just before the election in Wasco County. Okay. Just directly after that, he gave lectures, not private lectures. They were later broadcasts in Buddha Hall, but he was giving a talk which was known as, very appropriately this year, 20. This was when he was talking about the fascist regime in Rajneeshpuram, and he nailed Sheila's ass to the cross. This is December 1984. And then that tape got lost. It got lost, right? So guess what that means? It was basically Russian history there, censored and all that. Now, this is at the end of 1984. 1985, Sheila's away from the ranch a lot. And then in the summer, they tried to poison Devaraj, which was OSHA's private physician. And he's now called Amrito. Okay, that was in the summer. Then in August, and I know this from talking to Vina Schlegel, maybe you have heard of her. And that was just recently. I just discovered this recently. There was a meeting in Lao Tzu House with let's call it the old guard and the coming on guard. And the coming on guard was Hasia and what was then known as the Hollywood gang, right? And there was a meeting between all of them in Lao Tzu. And Vina told me, she was up at Lao Tzu House at that time, she was saying that Nirvana, who at that time, what was her name at the time? Vivek. Her name at that time was Vivek, who was Osho's, let's say, his girlfriend. So anyhow, what Vita told me recently is that Nirvana, or Vivek at that time, kept going back and forth between the meeting that was going on in the other room and coming back to the other place of the house where Vita was, saying, "I've never seen him so angry. I've never seen him so angry. I can hardly stand it." So she had to go back to be a witness to it. But at the same time, she was so upset by the intensity of that meeting. And basically, Osho was nailing Sheila's ass to the cross. This was in August, by the way, 1985. Hasia told me, before she died, obviously, this was like way back in the 80s, she told me that if Osho had talked to me like that, I would have committed suicide. Got it? So this is the end. Sheila leaves in September, and then the shit hits the fan, and all the crimes that had been committed, which most of the people on the ranch had no idea had been committed, then they were exposed by the Sannyasins, and they called in the other police and the FBI to investigate those crimes. So the ones who called them in were the Sannyasins. They didn't discover it. But they didn't want to believe that the Sannyasins weren't guilty of that, which is another version of the conspiracy. They didn't want to believe it. And therefore, you know, if one person's guilty, they're all guilty, which is basically one nigger is a bad nigger and they're all bad niggers, or a Muslim or anybody else, a Jew or anything like that. That's the kind of racism that was going on. Is that clear?
Yes. So first, I would like to clarify and expand a bit on the fact that Lakshmi was Osho's secretary before Sheila. And
yeah, for a long time.
And what I've read in your book confirms what Rashid, I'm sure you know Rashid, he recently wrote
that's the part I'm telling about. I didn't know about it until I'd read his book.
Exactly. So he wrote recently a book on Lakshmi, and he confirmed this part of the story that basically Lakshmi was asked by Osho to find a land in India for a long time.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
she didn't do it. She couldn't find
it. She couldn't. She couldn't find
it. Yeah.
Didn't so work
she,
out.
She couldn't find it. She tried. But then at the end, it seems like she kind of gave up a little bit, and she was more concerned about Sheila taking over rather than focusing more on keep trying to find the land in India. And that's part of the reason why then the whole commune eventually settled in America, because that was a real opportunity. I mean, that there was a land there.
Well, that's interesting that you read his book like that. First of all, he used a lot from my interview with Lakshmi in his book. And I'm not quite sure that that's a proper interpretation. I think there was probably something about that that's true. I'm not quite sure. I think the problem that Lakshmi was having, it was just difficult to find a place at the right time and the right. I wouldn't say that it was her fault that didn't happen. I don't know about that. So I couldn't say one way or the other. I do know that in that book, and a lot of the Indian Sannyasins have kind of tried to make a saint out of Lakshmi, which I think is rather an unfortunate thing. I don't think she was. I think she was weird, but there seems to be kind of post-death sanctification of the lady. You know, I guess to make a kind of a counterbalance to Sheila.
Yes, yeah.
I think she was a saint.
Then going back to Osho and Sheila, I think the big question that is on everyone's mind is, of course, no one can know. There are no kind of facts because no one can go inside Osho's mind, etc. But, you know, based on your research, what's your...
Even when he was alive, we couldn't go inside his mind.
Maybe there was nothing really there, but I don't know. Like,
There was a lot.
So based on your research and your personal opinion, what's your view on the reason why Osho put Sheila in charge of the commune? Because the narrative that goes that everything bad that happened is Sheila's fault, Sheila's evil, it's a little bit simplistic in my view.
Well, you're right about that. First of all, Absolutely right. I mean, it's like everything went wrong in Nazi Germany was Hitler's fault, right? Or Goebbels maybe do it, or, you know, Eichmann maybe do it, or something like that. The sannyasins themselves, even though they were not directly involved in the crimes, they were part of the problem because they didn't really just tackle the bitch and, you know, say, no, this is going too far. And the reason they did that is because she used the divide and conquer technique, which is all rulers are using all the time. They were, her basic strategy there was, okay, we've got to stick together because we've got all these forces on the outside and we've got to, you know, circle the wagons and we've got to protect ourselves from all those outside forces. And the more threats there were from the outside, the more the sannyasins were sort of pushed into kind of a herd mentality, you know, one size fits all response, one thing. So they didn't confront her, stop her, and, you know, put the brakes on what she was doing. That was one part. The other part of it is she said, well, this is what OSHA wants. And they didn't know any better. So they said, okay, it seems fucking weird to me, but, and a lot of them left. Okay. A lot of sannyasins left the ranch because they said, no way. It's too much for me. And they left or they never came. That's one part. The other part of it is those who were there and wanted to stay, they had to go along with Sheila or else guess what? They were kicked off the ranch. They said, get lost. Okay, so she had the power to make your life immediately miserable. So sannyasins were part of it, okay? Now, in terms of the ultimate responsibility, in terms of everything went wrong, it wasn't just Sheila. Obviously, the sannyasins had a kind of either an active or a passive. In other words, there were a lot of sannyasins who were actively involved on her side of the fence, and there were a lot of ones who were just uneasy about everything, but they didn't do anything directly because of their fear of being, you know, if they said anything, okay, that's it. Pack up your stuff and get out of the ranch this afternoon, right? Now, that's not an answer to your question. I realize it's not an answer, but just because you have questions and I have questions doesn't necessarily mean there are straightforward answers to those questions, okay? And all the people you're talking to, or the people you know, and all the people who have that question, and I would say this was the major breakpoint for the sannyasin movement, because those who had been there before said, oh, no, OSHA's a crook, and therefore, fuck them, and dropping my mala, you know. And this was the breakpoint. But in every, you know, OSHA in all the years, he told lots of stories about masters who organized stuff. Now, I'm not saying he did organize this, but he said there were masters who organized the point where the sannyasins either had to trust the master or they had to say, fuck off. I'm not saying this was one of those things. But it certainly cleared out a lot of people who were wavering, doubting, sitting on the fence. And but there's no way, as far as I can see, and I struggled with that point myself when I was writing the book and in the years since. At the same time, as far as I can see, there's no answer to it. Okay. I was just telling you what I just mentioned before is that he was basically pulling the rug out from under Sheila for the last year. So in other words, she had been in charge. She had done pretty good job up to say, like, let's put it the beginning of 1984. And then when she started going really, really off the rails, well, actually, she started going off the rails, as I think about it now, about 1983, but really totally haywire off the rails in 1984. And then he kept on pulling the rug more and more out from under her until she left. And then she said, you know, now Sheila's story, I told you last time that one of my interviewees who was in the government, he says, well, I don't know if a pathological liar sums it up well enough. So whatever Sheila says is totally unreliable. That's why I never bothered to interview her, even though all these other idiots, you know, wild, whatever it is, they interviewed, they went out of the way to interview her as if she could actually say anything. It's like asking Donald Trump for, you know, well, could you tell us the facts about this? I mean, it's absurd. There's no way on earth she's going to tell the truth. First of all, she probably doesn't know anymore because she, in those days, she was totally, you know, looped up on drugs. I don't know what kind of drugs, but she was always kind of like goofy. And then all of a sudden, you know, drugs and defending her ego, you know, no. And not only her ego, but her legal position in the world. There's no way on earth you could believe a damn thing she says. So there's no point in talking to her and no point in reading her book. That's the way I see it.
Yes, and also, I mean, she's a rotten disc. She's in total denial and she just keeps saying the same story. So I personally have no respect for the woman. But
I have no respect for people who are actually talking. I have no respect for the people who actually listen to her. She's just wrong. So not everything that went wrong in Rajneesh Poor is Sheila's fault. And as I said, she did a lot of good stuff and in a dubious way, but she got the damn thing going and running and all that on the rails. And but whatever happened afterwards, and she just can't afford to. So she's got some pretty damn karma built up.
Okay, look, I really appreciate your honest answer. You know, ultimately, there is no one clear answer, but I think it's important to describe what happened and the best of mm-hmm. our abilities to try to make sense of that.
Well, as I said before, you know, where we've grown up in a culture, let's call it the post-Enlightenment era, where we're used to having questions and getting answers. And the Enlightenment I'm talking about is obviously the 18th and 19th century. Okay, that's what I'm talking about. And the scientific revolution, all that. We're used to that. But there's lots of parts of the world where they just say, it's just Chinatown. You can't get an answer just because, oh, mommy, I want an answer. Well, I'm sorry, kiddo. There aren't answers there.
And then the other point I think that you made, which is something that everyone forgets, is that when this shit happened, the one that paid the highest price is Osho. You know, no one talks about that. You know, the sannyas movement suffered, many sannyasins left, some people lost all the hopes and money, and you know, the life was kind of, you know, a bit upset. But the man was put in prison, was poisoned, and he suffered the last few years of his life in excruciating pain.
Yeah.
And he lost his life at, you know, 58, 59. He was young. I mean, he could have been alive today. Now he could have been, you know, giving talks. So
I don't know about that last part, because even from the very beginning, he was always talking about my ship is waiting. And I, just the fact that I wake up in the morning is amazing. So that was in terms of his connection to the body was tenuous, he said, from the time he got enlightened, which was 1953. But then he kept on building up his power and all that. So I don't know whether he would still be alive today. Whether he lost the most out of everything, I don't know if that's true either. First of all, because in a way, he didn't have anything to lose. He says, I don't exist. I'm a dead man. He says, there's nobody here. There's an absence. This chair is empty. Even though you see me sitting in it, this chair is empty. So did he lose? No. Who was the major loser in all this and is up to this point is the world. And the world is the major loser. And no sannyasins, of course, they were also major losers in terms of money. Lots of money was lost. Sure, lots. But the major loser, in my opinion, and this is just my opinion, I can't prove it. Okay, this is not evidence-based opinion. But major loser is the world because, in my opinion, Osho has so much to share with the world. His major theme of Zorba the Buddha combining the spiritual with the physical and living life to the limit, but also seeing the transcendence of the physical and the mental is a major lesson for everyone who's sort of a sentient being. And because he has been basically rolled in tar and then dumped in cement shoes at the bottom of a media ocean, is a loss to the world. And that's another major reason that I put all that time and effort into the book, was because I said, well, okay, you make up your own opinion what he has to say, but listen, don't let it get drenched in tar and feathers and cement shoes at the bottom of the ocean. Okay, so the major loser is the world.
Fair enough. Even though personally, that's my opinion, I think I agree with you on that, because he didn't complete his work in a way, or we can say that his work was shortened,
right?
Because he left earlier than he would have liked. But at the same time, I see Osho as a man, and from what I see and what I understand, he suffered incredibly a lot of pain due to the consequences of the poisoning. And that what you said just brings a beautiful step to the next part I wanted to discuss with you, and the word lost, because what is left is a lot of media pile of shit, excuse my language.
No, I don't excuse it. I would probably go even stronger than that.
So that even today in 2020, 30 years after Osho left the body, we have this predominantly very negative media coverage about anything related to Osho. And it's not just about the sex guru and the Rolls Royces, but it's also about a lot of rumors about the crimes, the legal activities, the drug trafficking, and all sorts of other serious allegations surrounding Osho and the sannyasins.
Right.
And I think that this kind of defaming and misinformation campaign started right about when Osho was deported, right?
It was there all along.
And also during the world tour, Osho was banned from 21 countries. And I understand that the USA government was behind that.
That's also in the book. That's in the book.
I think what they did, what I've learned from your book, reading your book, is that they had a file that they would send to the other government, and the file was full of all these allegations. So can you explain that?
Okay. Well, it wasn't always with files. It was just sometimes, you know, with a phone call. A lot of this stuff happens, you know, where there's no paper trail. But actually, there were files. And well, I have copies. They weren't in the book. I didn't copy them in the book because obviously I couldn't do everything. But I have copies of those files, for example, that were sent to the Uruguayan, I can't remember now, to Uruguay or something. And when Osho was staying there, he's basically, you know, given the right to stay there. And they were even thinking of granting him citizenship in Uruguay. And then all of a sudden, he gets basically, you know, tossed out, and you have to leave town by sunset, that kind of stuff. That's in the stuff. So the U.S. government was definitely tracking and tracing and defaming him after he left America. And they were, you know, they were spreading rumors about him all the time. And they were basically accusing him of all the criminal activities, which he had exposed. So they were just, you know, it was a death of character assassination. And basically, that was what was going on. And I mean, we're not talking about, you know, just, you know, banana republics. We're talking about Sweden wouldn't let him in. Switzerland, they wouldn't even let him in Switzerland. They wouldn't even let him out of the airport. And that was one of the reasons why I gave that title to that chapter in Spain, mainly on the plane. Because he landed the plane, they had a private plane, landed, and they wouldn't even let him off the tarmac, okay? That's definitely proved, and that's in that chapter, the whole chapter.
Now, in the last part of the interview, I'd like to go back to your book and also discuss the fact that your book is evidence-based. You expose a lot of facts. And what's been the follow-up in the media? I mean, has
nothing, zero, zero, nothing.
Challenge your facts.
The answer is zero, nothing, zilch, nada, tipota. You know what tipota means?
No, I don't, but I get the meaning.
That means Greek. Niente. Okay, that's it.
Yeah. And any one of the person that you expose that have been doing illegal activities, essentially, or at least there are enough facts to start an investigation, to follow up, has anyone picked up the work you have done?
No one. No sannyasins have done it. No journalists have done it. Nobody's pushed the story further. What the other people have done, I told you, wild, wild country, is they basically, you know, just gone backwards and, you know, they did that. By the way, I've since discovered that that's quite a common procedure in documentaries kind of that type. Ken Burns is an exemplar of that. He did with the Civil War documentary, and also with the Vietnam, that they kind of soft soap everything so nobody gets too uncomfortable. So my book makes everybody uncomfortable, and that's why nobody's followed it up. They just don't want to touch it with a barge pole. So that was the disappointment. But as I said, there are lots of disappointments in life, and that's just one of them.
And within the sannyas world, what's been the response?
Well, if every sannyasin bought a copy, I'd be rich, and I'd be able to support lots of projects which I can't support because they haven't responded properly. Properly, in my opinion, properly. I mean, they obviously are not obliged to read the book, believe it, or whatever. But if only they had bought the book and read it, there would be such a groundswell of noise. But there was quite a, in the beginning, when it first published in 1993, there was quite a following. And then it all of a sudden, you know, basically petered out. And it just didn't go anywhere beyond that. But, you know, there was a lot of praise from people. So it wasn't totally ignored, not at all. But at the same time, no follow-up and no kind of major action by anybody.
Yeah, I personally have been sannyasin for many years. And I have
How long have you been a sannyasin?
Well, 2000, since 2000. And I've been involved with Osho from even earlier than that. And I mean, painfully, only recently I've come across your book. So, you know, I don't know. But I hope you see, like, as soon as I came across your book, I was quite impressed. I read it all. It's 500 pages.
I think it's longer than 500. I think it's 600 pages, but I can't remember. I have to take a look.
A long book. So where people can find your book, if anyone listening to this interview, hopefully I really highly, highly recommend to get the book and get informed. You know, it's very informative. Anyone who is a sannyasin or anyone who is interested in Osho, this is the number one book that they should read. So where people can find your book?
Well, you put it on the link. You see it in same place you bought it, because no publisher wanted to publish it. And now let's go back to the history of the book while we're on that topic. First of all, I originally wrote this book in 1989. I did the research for the book starting at the beginning of 1989, gathered all my materials, and wrote it all in 1 year. In other words, a project which normally takes 3 or 4 years, I did it at supersonic speed in 1 year. Nearly killed me, by the way. Really ruined my health, but okay. And then it was ready, finished a month before Osho died. So in other words, when Osho died, the book was already available for publication then. Nobody was interested. Nobody. Zero. They were calling it a puff piece. They were saying, well, we already know this story, so there's no point in reading anything else on it. And basically, the whole premise is everything you think you know is wrong. But nobody was interested. So that was basically written as scoop journalism. So I didn't really have too much time to kind of fine-tune it with, more literary flourishes and intellectual flourishes. In other words, giving background for what was going on with other groups in the same time. In other words, the the historical record in terms of other groups being targeted. So it wasn't just the sannyasins, it was other groups being targeted as well. So over the years, I rewrote it a couple of times since then, and the book you have now is like about 40% larger than the first edition, with much more literary style and much more intellectual background. So that's the difference between the first version, which came out in 1993 by an Indian publisher, and then the new version, which is to buy online. So I just wanted to say that. But the follow-up in terms of going further with the story, zero.
Zero. Okay, that's unfortunate, but what to do? You know, it's like this, and hopefully, you know, something will happen in the future, or maybe someone else will pick it up at some point, or maybe we need to find a different way to present it. Or
I'm not holding my breath, but I always remain hopeful. I'm basically an optimist. I remain hopeful, but I'm not holding my breath. Don't you hold your breath either.
You dedicated a lot of time and energy to investigate this story that effectively clears up Osho's name.
Yeah.
What do you think would be a new project for someone who wants to do something for Osho, something that you did a book? What else could be done?
Well, what I also did is I wrote a movie script for the book. In other words, I fictionalized. Well, I kind of, you know, did a crossover between fiction and the book. So I used the book for facts, and I made characters where they were getting involved with the story from the outside. And that's actually, the film is quite good. It's a brilliant film script, if I do say so myself. And there are other people going on and trying to make films about Osho, but they're just either silly or stupid. And some of them are just silly. And the reason they're silly, by the way, is not because they weren't done with love and care, but it is if you're trying to break into the public audience. In other words, if you're preaching not to the choir, but if you're talking to people who say either skeptical or say, you're crazy, he's a crook, and whatever. If you're talking to those kind of people, you can't do kind of a silly Billy once upon a time story. Nobody cares about it.
Yeah, of course. You need to make it evidence-based and
drama. If you're going to make a film, you have to do drama.
So if I understand correctly, you have the script for a movie ready to go, but you need like someone to make it happen?
Yeah. That's one thing, yeah. And I've had that script in the draw. The Russians have an expression, as Chet will probably know, writing for the draw, which were Russian writers during the time of the big freeze. They said, well, it's never going to be published, so I'm writing for the draw. That's a Russian expression. She'll know it, obviously.
Okay. So. Yeah, I'm sure she will know. Okay.
Okay.
Max, look, we are heading towards the end. It's been a real pleasure. Really, really enjoyed learning even more and clarifying some questions I had about the book. So again, if you're happy with that, I will put the link of your book into the show notes.
Yeah. And perhaps happy.
You know, and the website. So if anyone reads the book and then they have questions or they want to have any clarification, they get in touch with you there.
Right.
So is there anything else you would like to add before we finish the interview?
Well, no, I think you pretty much covered as much as you can possibly can in this kind of format. You've done an extremely good job in questioning me and interviewing me. So you obviously have picked up the tricks of the trade. So congratulations on your interest. What actually that'll be sufficient. Let's put it like that. But congratulations to you and your project, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I really hope that after the interview, people who didn't know about the book, now they will become aware of it and they will get it. And again, I just highly, highly, highly recommend. It's very well written, and it's just fascinating. It's maybe daunting because of the volume, but once you start reading it, I finished it very quickly because I just couldn't stop reading. I was so interested in it. So yeah, amazing. Thank you so much for putting so much work and so much time, energy and money on making this book.
Okay. Ciao.
Ciao. Thank you so much. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it and leave a review. Visit lavoshow.com for more episodes, blogs, or to connect with us.